Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
17 years ago, Jerry Yang co-founded a company you might have heard of. He changed the internet and made himself a fortune along the way. Today, though, Jerry Yang resigned from Yahoo, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal, and this is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 17th of January. Good to have you here. Jerry Yang's actual title at Yahoo, besides former CEO, member of the board of directors, and co-founder, was Chief Yahoo. Whatever that job description actually meant, there's an opening for it today, because not long after the closing bell, Yahoo announced Yang has left the company entirely. Kara Swisher covers Yahoo for All Things D. Kara, it's good to talk to you.
Hi, how you doing?
Not unexpected, right, this move by Jerry Yang?
Well, you know, I wrote about it last week saying it was one of the possibilities. I mean, it's certainly dramatic because he's the key founder of that company. And so I said it might happen because of all the pressure that was building upon this board, and he was sort of at the center of it and the one, I think, most associated with a lot of the troubles at Yahoo, him and the chairman, Roy Bostock, who didn't resign, which was interesting.
Yeah. Let's go back over those troubles. The big one that sticks in my memory is turning down that offer from Microsoft of $47-something billion.
Yeah, that was a big one. That was I think it was $41 billion. That was one of those mistakes you can't take back. And actually, in a recent discussion with him, I suggested that possibly he should leave. And he said, "Do you have any better ideas?" And I said, "Well, you could build a time machine and go back and sell yourself to Microsoft." He thought that was easier, but apparently this was.
Did he laugh at all when you said that?
Oh yeah, it was a funny conversation.
Yeah.
But it was definitely a great error. He would defend himself on that it wasn't a true offer and that it wasn't at the right time, but I think history has shown that it was a mistake not to sell.
What is it that's broken with Yahoo? I mean, what has to be fixed?
Oh, well, so many things. It's too big, too many people. It hasn't changed with the time. It's a paradigm company of another era in computing. It doesn't have a strong mobile strategy. It is still wedded to the desktop. It is still, in the old paradigm of portals versus social. It goes on, and they've missed a lot of these opportunities to change themselves. And after a while in technology, you know, if you don't change, you die.
Yeah. The press releases today said all the things you usually expect,
Much
congratulations for Jerry, all this stuff. Was he forced out?
It looks like he walked out on his own motor, but it was mounting pressure in that regard. And I don't think he wanted to be caught up in another cycle of trouble and be the focus of it.
Yeah. The new CEO, Scott Thompson, he's been there mere weeks, right?
Yeah, he just got there. We did write about that. We did find out about that and wrote about it. But he may be part of this. He may, have said, "I need a clean slate and I need to move on without Jerry hanging over me." That could have been a possibility. But I think nobody would have forced Jerry Yang out except Jerry Yang. And I think probably he realized the writing was on the wall and the time had come and all those cliches.
Yeah. Very quickly, the share price jumped like 4% as soon as news of this hit. The market's been waiting for this, huh?
Yeah, I think so. I think, there's been troubles with the Asian partners that they're negotiating with now. He may have been a problem there. But, again, aside from all that, the man has a legacy. He's one of the great internet pioneers and entrepreneurs. And so you don't want to forget that in all these recent year stumbles. And so it's hard to, balance out short-term interest, of which this is a good thing, versus the long-term impact that he's made on the internet, which is significant.
Right. Kara Swisher at All Things D. Kara, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Elsewhere in American capitalism today, it was mostly a tale of two banks, Wells Fargo and Citigroup by name. 2011 turns out to have been very, very good to Wells Fargo. It posted record profits for the fourth quarter and for the year this morning. Despite the stubborn housing market, it somehow managed to make good money in mortgage finance. Citigroup, however, not so good. An 11% drop in earnings, traceable, it says, to a slump in revenue from trading stocks and bonds. Because here's the thing, even though the raw data on the economy kept improving through the year, our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains things are still a little bit shaky for the American banking industry.
First and foremost, analysts blame Europe. They say investors have been sitting on the sidelines waiting for the European debt crisis to be resolved. Until that happens, investment banks will find it tough to turn a profit.
When you look at companies that focus more on trading as well as investment banking, those are the ones that are taking a big hit.
Todd Schoenberger is managing director at Land Colt Trading.
You have to suspect that trading volumes will continue to be anemic throughout the rest of the year. Merger and acquisition activity, investment banking activity will continue to be benign. So we have to wonder where the dollars are going to come from.
And Schoenberger says healthy banks continue to be vital to a healthy recovery. At South Beach Capital Markets, Bruce Furster says today's Citigroup numbers suggest the financial giant might make a healthier profit by just spinning off its investment banking business. He says investment banking has also been hurt by another waiting game. Regulators are still sorting out the financial reforms passed by Congress a year and a half ago in the Dodd-Frank bill.
You still have this huge regulatory cloud. What does Dodd-Frank really mean? Well, I think it means this. You stop 10 people on the street, if you can find 10 people that even know what Dodd-Frank is, and you're going to get 10 different views on where it's going to take the business. Uncertainty makes it difficult to run the business.
Analysts say Wells Fargo has found success by going in another direction. It's turned a profit on its mortgage banking business by focusing largely on loans to the most creditworthy of home buyers. But it's far from clear that there's enough of that business to go around and boost the bottom lines of its rivals as well. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
What started out as a fine day in the equity markets turned into one that was, you know, okay. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tomorrow could be a long and trying day online. Try going to Wikipedia in the morning, see what happens, or the social news website Reddit or TwitPic for a picture off your Twitter account, because I'm here to tell you it's not going to go so well. Those sites and as many as 5,000 others say they might just go black tomorrow, shut things down entirely, in protest over two bills that are now making their way through Congress. They would give the government broad new powers to fight online piracy. And that, in turn, has raised claims in the tech world that Congress really just doesn't get the internet at all. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Some congressmen practically brag about being out of touch with the internet.
Chairman, I'm a pretty old-fashioned guy who still hasn't figured out how, even whether I want to use all the fancy technological advances that are out there.
That was North Carolina Congressman Mel Watt. He's one of the sponsors of the Stop Online Piracy Act, known as SOPA. The bill, and a similar one in the Senate, includes broad tools to thwart online piracy. One would force search engines like Google to stop linking to sites that post pirated content. Another would stop advertisers from doing business with those sites.
The ramifications are very complex.
Jack Lerner is a law professor at the University of Southern California.
That complexity is not something that can easily be dealt with from a legislative standpoint.
The bills have created a war between Hollywood and Silicon Valley. Big tech companies say the legislation would make it impossible for them to do business. Hollywood says without the legislation, its business is being destroyed. Cynthia Sanders is with the law firm Oberkaler in Baltimore.
Not everybody in the entertainment and media world agree.
The same is true in Washington. The Obama administration has opposed portions of the bill, and the House has also pulled back. But with piracy costing up to $775 billion a year, virtually everyone agrees the bills in some form will survive. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Five more bodies were pulled from the Costa Concordia off the coast of Italy today. That makes 11 confirmed fatalities, 29 passengers and crew still missing. It is a rare and deadly tragedy for the cruise industry, which has been growing at an astonishing 7% a year. So where does it go now? Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
Cruise passengers have doubled every decade since the 70s, in part because the industry had widely been considered safe.
The cruise industry generally is pretty good at keeping their dirty linen under the radar.
Ross Klein watches the sector from St. John's College in Canada. He says as tragic as the Costa Concordia shipwreck is, they got lucky. Their water was shallow, and the medium-sized ship carried only 4,200 people.
In this case, they had some time for the evacuation. The ship didn't sink, but if it was in deeper water, it could have been much more disastrous in terms of loss of life.
What is bad is the timing. January is a critical month for families to book trips for the summer. And for now, Jamie Katz over at Morningstar thinks some will scare off.
The most kind of pertinent fallout that you're going to see is in cruise bookings. They are going to have to discount pretty significantly to get people on ships.
Most analysts bet on a short-term impact in a high-growth sector. The boats are getting bigger, and they register in countries exempt from U.S. wage and tax laws. But hold on, says consultant Mark Murphy at Travel Alliance. He thinks this disaster could affect a key longer-run demographic, cruise virgins.
About 80% of the U.S. population has never taken a cruise, and events like these really deter people who may have been considering taking a cruise.
So far, the industry has managed to build more and more ships and fill them with affordable getaways for $60-$70 a night. All that depends on enticing new passengers. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I don't know about you, but the talk of bank earnings from Bob Moon up at the beginning of the broadcast today brought me right back to the financial crisis and how during the post-mortem after the meltdown, so much of the talk was about Wall Street's failure to plan, failure to anticipate the remote chance that once in a good long while things go horribly wrong, and when they do, it can be really, really bad. That rude awakening has changed the way we think about all kinds of economic and human disasters, and it turns out that how severe the impact is has a lot to do with how long the disaster and our response to it lasts. Marketplace's David Brancaccio is here to talk about it. Hey, David.
Hey there.
So this is the proverbial black swan, yes?
Yeah, you bet. Realization that just because something is very unlikely doesn't mean it won't happen. But this time, it's not just about managing financial risk. Chatham House, the international affairs think tank in London, looked at a range of bad things that can happen. They call them high-impact, low-probability events. And among the findings, when a catastrophe strikes a major hub in our interconnected world here, we got 1 week before severe disruption sets in.
We have a week? How do they know?
Well, they looked at a case study. They looked at the case of the eruption in Iceland of Eyjafjallajökull.
Really? Are you going to try that?
The ash cloud from the volcano.
I could show off here and do it right, but I won't. But anyway.
I bet you could, my friend. Researchers found that had the ash kept airports shut just a couple more days, it would have taken at least a month for companies to recover. Here's Bernice Lee, a research director at Chatham House.
What we found is that a lot of companies, even if they did prepare for them, they did not actually prepare for a prolonged disruption. So if the crisis went on, many of them would really be stuck and wondering how to respond.
Her report urges industries to think long and hard about that popular practice, we're always talking about it, just-in-time delivery of components that can leave a company dangling even after a far-off catastrophe. But also, they say, do stress tests.
Like we do with the banks, right? Stress tests.
Yeah, and build on that idea. The busiest hub for airborne cargo in the U.S. is the airport in Memphis, Tennessee. Yeah. The New Madrid earthquake fault.
Well, now, wait, you've got to explain why, right? Because it's because, who's there?
FedEx is there, and UPS to a large extent, nicely in the middle of the country. But they're near a big earthquake fault, a dangerous one. It turns out that airport tested for quakes that include a very unlikely, very big one. John Grayo is VP of operations for the airport.
We actually have a project that should be complete in the next few months here that should protect us up to what they call a 1 in 2,475 chance of occurring. It's vital that we keep the airfield open. That's what we bring to the table.
Yeah, they turned out a questionable section where the runway that ferries the FedEx jets across a road is getting fixed now, is vulnerable.
All right, so that's kind of infrastructure, and I get that, but there's lots of things in this country we need to spend money on. Is getting ready for a black swan one of them?
Yeah, it's tough when government budgets are this tight. I talked to Daniel Kanuski, who does homeland security policy at George Washington University. He says people talking about planning for remote possibilities like this have a tough pitch.
They'd probably be thrown out of the room and told they were crazy to make an investment in some of those areas when we have much more pressing threats that face us every day, you know, with Al-Qaeda attacks or natural disasters that occur, whether it be a hurricane in Florida or a wildfire in California. Those are clear and present dangers.
So where does that leave us, David? I mean, what are we supposed to do now?
Well, Kanuski wants policymakers to have what he calls an open and honest dialogue with the public so that we can decide where we're going to put limited disaster planning money.
David Brancaccio and our series Economy 4.0. David, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Coming up,
I'd like to show you some people making crayons. Let's come along. I have a film of it here.
Mr. Rogers and the State of American Manufacturing. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, so Wall Street started strong but couldn't take it all the way to the bank. The Dow Industrials, which was up 150 points early on, added just 60 at the bell. That's a 0.5%, closed at 12,482. The NASDAQ put on 17 points, 2/3%, 27.28. The S&P 500 tipped up 1/3%, 14 points, ended things at 1293. Financials told the sad story today. Citigroup withdrew more than 8% after reporting a drop in quarterly profit. As we said, J.P. Morgan Chase unloaded nearly 3%. Morgan Stanley off 2.25%. Today on the upside, Caterpillar unearthed a gain of 0.8%. Boeing also up 0.8%. United Technologies rose 1.2% today. Not surprisingly, Carnival Cruise Line was one of the worst performers of the day, down 14%. Bond prices held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-notes at 1.86%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its monthly producer price index. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market for January. And no speeding in the nation's capital. The National Sheriffs Association Winter Conference gets underway. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We mentioned a couple of days ago, last week maybe, that 2011 was a record-setting year for American retail. $5 trillion in sales, give or take. Today, though, some context for that figure. A report from the Retail Action Project says most retail work is now part-time and that racking up hours to get by is getting harder. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
This is our Facebook group page where we switch shifts.
18-year-old Jay Cole works as a cashier at Abercrombie & Fitch. He's checking a Facebook page on his iPhone. Workers from his store have set up a kind of trading post for shifts.
This one says, any 4-to-9s today, any shifts for tomorrow, text me. Basically, they're just begging for shifts. It's very competitive. Once the shift is posted, within seconds, it's gone.
The sour economy has put more workers in Cole's position, says Carrie Gleason, director of the Retail Action Project, a partner with the retail union.
I've seen an increase in unpredictability, and people are not getting enough hours.
Gleason says those constantly changing schedules put stress on workers. More than half of retail workers surveyed were part-time. A third said they're supporting their family. Frank Badillo is senior economist with Kantar Retail. He says stores have been saving money by scrapping full-time, full-benefit positions. Part-time workers can ebb and flow with demand.
As we've come out of this recession, many shoppers have remained very value-focused. That has continued to put pressure on many of these retailers.
It's not just retail workers. More than 8 million Americans are working fewer hours than they'd like, says economist Tom Nardone with the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's roughly double what it was before the recession.
We typically see this go up during the recessions and then come down during the recoveries. Because you have people who have their hours reduced or you have people who can only find jobs that offer a part-time schedule.
18-year-old Jay Cole supports himself with his part-time Abercrombie job. He makes $9 an hour.
It's really tough, especially when they give you 10 hours a week. That's just $90. I have like bills, like really expensive bills to pay, like $500 a month.
Cole says he needs 25 hours a week to pay the rent. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
If you've skipped some or even most of the umpteen Republican presidential debates this election year, first of all, totally get it. They do kind of run together. But in the last couple of them, at least, there's been a certain through line, a certain socioeconomic angle to it. Here's Newt Gingrich in South Carolina last night.
More people have been put on food stamps by Barack Obama than any president in American history.
Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports there is more to it than that.
More than 45 million Americans got food assistance from the government last year, but anti-hunger advocates say food stamps, or SNAP, as the federal program is currently called, isn't just for people on welfare.
Many of the people who are taking advantage of SNAP or on food stamps are indeed the working poor.
Paula Thornton Greer with Feeding America says nearly a third of food stamp recipients have a job, but they don't earn enough to feed themselves. Melissa Cahill is a 24-year-old single mother in Derry, New Hampshire. She and her daughter have been receiving food stamps for 5 years, despite Melissa's job at a restaurant.
where I'm only working part-time right now and I pay my own rent and bills and gas and all that stuff, I wouldn't have any money at the end of my paycheck to buy food for me and her, so it does help me out a lot.
Many food stamp recipients are eligible because of the economic downturn. Michael Foster lives in Minneapolis. He lost his job in human resources in 2009. His other benefits have run out, and he survives on the $200 a month in food aid.
I'm caught in this black hole of the private sector doesn't want to hire me, and I would love to not be on food stamps, but without them, I would starve.
Lynn Brantley at the Capital Area Food Bank in Washington says more than half the people showing up at her food banks have jobs, some with two or three.
The result of the increase in food stamps is not Obama wanting to make it happen, but it's the need that's happening out here in the community because of lost jobs, lost wages, welfare reform.
The recession, she says, has boosted demand at some food banks by over 200%. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Among the indisputable economic truths about 21st century America is this. Manufacturing in this country just isn't what it used to be. Millions of jobs have disappeared. Thousands of factories are gone, too. But even so, even with everything that's gone, a lot of us still know what those factories looked like, thanks in no small part to the late, great Fred Rogers. Sarah Alvarez reports.
When I was a kid, I was fascinated by Mr. Rogers' factory tours. I loved watching how things were made, like trumpets and shoes and flashlights.
I'd like to show you some people making crayons. Let's come along. I have a film of it here.
These places were full of metal equipment and conveyor belts lit by fluorescent lights. They were also full of people. I wanted to know how the factories in some of those videos are doing now. In 1998, Mr. Rogers visited Headstrom Entertainment in Ashland, Ohio, to find out how people make a basic plastic ball. When he was there, the factory was bustling. But, as Mr. Rogers would ask...
What's happening now?
Well, you know, we moved our factory to China in 2004 out of just sheer need.
That's Jim Branning. He runs Headstrom Entertainment.
Wages and things had gotten to the point and benefits that really made it impossible to compete with the Chinese product.
Branning says he did what he could for years to keep his factory in the U.S. We're talking automation, increased efficiency, and cutting $1 million a year in costs.
It still wasn't enough long-term to support a domestic factory.
In the end, Branning was only able to keep his headquarters and a small industrial plastics business in Ohio. He says the real problem with making toys in the U.S. is this. People expect things to be cheap. When the toy factory closed, people were only willing to pay around 99 cents for the basic ball. That's less than people paid for the same ball in 1967. Branning says he just can't make products for that price here anymore. But there is a factory using the same process and in the same space Mr. Rogers saw in 1985. It's in Oak Park, Illinois.
Okay, we'll put the film in picture-picture and see how people make bass violins in a factory.
The factory is Link Bass and Cello. Everything in the wood shop is covered in sawdust, and there are parts of stringed instruments everywhere.
I mean, it's old school.
Tom Link is the owner.
They're amazed at it that you're still around as an instrument maker because we are a dwindling number.
Link's business is hanging on, but his production is down about 80%. Staff is down too, from around 15 to 3 people, because these days almost all cellos are made in China. Link's company has adjusted. It now concentrates on selling more expensive upright basses. Small manufacturers of specialty products have done better than others over the last decade. But Link says something else is important. As Mr. Rogers explained, an upright bass is really big.
You see, it's about as tall as a mom or a dad.
With oil prices high, shipping anything big from China gets expensive. Tom Link says these shipping costs have saved his business. In fact, his is one of the few factories from the Mr. Rogers videos still around. But there is hope for new factories. Wallace Hopp is a manufacturing expert. He says certain types of products should still be made here in the U.S.
High tech, you know, you'd see things like, medical devices or things that, you're trying to match supply with volatile demand. Things that are sort of hot for a week. Well, those kind of things make sense to make locally.
The kinds of factories Mr. Rogers visited are pretty much a thing of the past. But if they're lucky, Americans can find manufacturing work making a new generation of products.
It takes so many people who care to make things work well, doesn't it?
I'm Sarah Alvarez for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which you can only wonder whether the president's reelection staff has been reading the papers the past 3 years. The Democratic National Committee announced today that Mr. Obama is going to give his nomination acceptance speech in the big football stadium in Charlotte, North Carolina. That's where the convention is going to be, in Charlotte. And the stadium is the home of the NFL's Carolina Panthers, which means 74,000 of the party faithful will be able to gather in, wait for it, Bank of America Stadium. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 60 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ put on 17 points, 2/3%. The S&P 500 gained 4 points, 1/3 of 1%. Thanks today to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rada Bead. Coming up next time, back here, trying for something better in the Motor City.
I would hope to be billed as something along the lines of Esquire, zoomed in on the Metro Detroit area.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.